So today is Good Friday 2015. And there is a rhythm to the Good Fridays that we've been meeting in this beautiful space, in this deeply welcoming space for so many years. We meet on a day that is marked by a cultural awareness of profound suffering. And we meet on this day with a hope alive in our hearts, in all our hearts, that there is in our lives not just suffering, but the possibility of healing suffering, of transcending suffering, and of ourselves being less and less the cause of suffering. And maybe this is one of the simplest, most fundamental, and most profound truths of all, that some of the suffering in our lives can be lifted, can be seen differently. And certainly, some of the suffering that is in our lives can be avoided because we need not cause it. And one of the most formidable challenges in front of every single one of us is that we take it upon ourselves, wherever possible, and as His Holiness would say, it is always possible, wherever possible, that we ourselves become increasingly sources of healing, sources of acceptance, sources of tolerance, sources of forgiveness, sources of inclusion, rather than sources of harm. You might think, and we're all tempted to think, but the harm I cause is very petty. And it is. I don't for a moment think that anyone in this room is causing devastating harm. Of course not. But we are all human creatures. And sometimes even our petty hurts accumulate. They accumulate. And some of them are so unnecessary. But they arise out of a conditioned mind. And one of the indescribable privileges of being able to look at these things within a spiritual context is that we can begin not just to understand, but to experience that the conditioned mind is always limited. It's limited by the conditioning that we've received through all the ideologies that we're subject to. Yeah? But what spirituality, or what unconfined mystical spirituality teaches us, is that the conditioned mind can be liberated from some of the conditioning that we have received, and particularly from some of the conditioning that tells us that we are justified in harming, that we are justified in divisive behavior, or justified in hurtful behavior, or justified in wounding behavior. We can heal that. And along with that, we can also heal any ways in which we do injustice to ourselves. And we do injustices to ourselves. And I'll really talk much more about that, because it is so fundamentally a question of identity. And if I look at my own work, which I've developed in terms of my books over the last 32 years, but if I think of it even more deeply than that, that I first became aware, without having any language for this, of course, that there are spiritual questions that are vibrating with energy, that are vibrating with an invitation to let us enter them. And my first knowledge of that came when I was 6 years old through suffering. And many, many, many of us will have awakenings through these times of suffering, which we would do anything to avoid. And yet they crack us open and they allow some light of inspiration and insight to enter. Yeah? Or, I could put it even more precisely, they offer an opportunity. And then in this dance, it is up to us also to take the next step. And you know, we can become very moralistic, very judgmental about those who choose to and those who don't choose to. And all I would say in that context is, what a great good fortune it is if we can choose to. Don't please for a moment think this makes us superior in any way whatsoever. It is simply our good fortune. If we can begin to dance with that generosity of insight, with that generosity of inspiration, with that generosity of spirit, if we can even begin to have a little touch of the finger, not even a dance, then we are so fortunate. It is not just our superiority in any way. On the contrary, we could just prostrate ourselves with humility at our good fortune. Yeah. So if I think about this long progress, becoming more conscious, say when I was in my teens, and then diverting in many, many ways, all of which were part of it. But if I think very particularly about these 32 years of writing the books, which is very challenging, and I come to recognize that at the heart of all of this are questions of identity. Who are you? Why are you here? Where are you going? And what are you learning on the way? Where are you allowing yourself to learn to be more alive, more generous, more robust, more exuberant, more encouraging, less self-absorbed, more engaged, more loving, more delighted, more awesome, and more compassionate. And not just for others, also for yourself. Because it is, of course, the compassion that will allow you to let so much that is trivial and confining and petty, to let that go. When I was thinking about this question of identity, and it is at the not just at the heart of these teachings, I looked at this from a psychological point of view and a social point of view and a gender point of view very, very thoroughly in Intimacy and Solitude, which was the first of my sort of major non-fiction books. What is the self? Who is the self? And we need to think about this, because until we have some sense of who the self is, we'll have a very hazy sense of who and what the other is, and in a sense what we owe them. What we owe them in terms of our conduct. We think a great deal about what others owe us. But let's think today, because we can, because we are lucky enough to, also to think about the other more generously. And then when I came to write Seeking the Sacred, which is perhaps my most recent book other than Heaven on Earth, about who we are and where we're going and what we're becoming, I also wanted to write a great deal about this question of identity, because I wrote there, and I feel it so strongly, that your life is not just the personal matter, that your choices, your conduct, are also creating the immediate world around you, and then with the inevitable onflow of interbeing, we're all connected, with the inevitable onflow of interbeing, that is creating the world beyond ourselves also. So we all belong in the human tragedies, and we all belong in the human achievements. We lift one another together. Yeah. Even if we just think for a moment with great gratitude of the teachers that we've had in our lives, and I don't just mean spiritual teachers only, and I don't just mean the people who praised us or comforted us. I mean also the people who have taught us, because they've reminded us of what we still need to know. So, again, I want to say that sentence. Your life is not a personal matter only. You know, John Donne wrote that famous line in the 16th century, was it? Or the 17th century. No man, meaning no person, is an island. That was a tremendous insight. None of us is an island. And yet our moments of greatest despair always come when we feel isolated. When we feel isolated, our moments of despair come. But they're a trick of the mind. We can feel isolated, but this is not a truth. The truth is that we are deeply and inevitably connected, which is why when we look at all of these questions about conduct within the context of our spiritual growth, we can never think about ourselves in isolation. And I find that very, very consoling. In other words, it's up to me and it's not up to me. It's up to me and it's all up to me and it's not all up to me. Do you see that paradox right there? I spoke yesterday evening also about the jewels from the different traditions, the jewels from the different philosophies, some of which are not called religions, like the Tao Te Ching, for example. And they all bring us to conduct. Because belief will always be a question of opinion, won't it? However, there are some things that we can come to trust that we could pretty much call beliefs because we have experienced them. We have, for example, experienced, every one of us, how fruitful it is, how, and I use that word really advisedly, how fruitful it is, how nourishing it is, how uplifting it is, how consoling it is to be in the presence of someone who is capable of loving life and loving. This question of presence is very, very central in all that we're talking about. Because when, for example, we take a few moments of quiet at the beginning of our day, call it meditation, call it reflection, call it setting the compass, doesn't matter what you call it. When we enter the place of the quieter mind, doesn't matter if it's not quiet, of the quieter mind, when we come to a safe place within ourselves, solid ground within ourselves, when we come to a place of peace within ourselves, we are also coming into the presence of love. And the more familiar that place becomes, the more we familiarize ourselves with the wonder that that place is not outside ourselves. That place is within ourselves. That we ourselves are beings of love. We are born in love. We return to love, and I'm not talking about physical conception, which may or may not be loving. We come from love. I showed Hilary yesterday a tiny little 20-second video my daughter sent me of my little newest teacher, Charlie, who's 16 weeks old, laughing with all his being. We come from love. Yeah? So when we return to the presence of quiet within ourselves, love within ourselves, then we become more and more naturally able to be that vehicle, that representative, that expression of love in our daily lives. And of course, I want to rush to say to you immediately, we will fail many times, but even some of those failures can begin to have a certain power to wake us up. The failures are themselves going to tell a story, and there will be a pattern to that story. And the more aware we are of the pattern of that story, of where we choose to withhold rather than give, where we choose to criticize rather than encourage, where we choose to foster our bitterness rather than letting it go and noticing what is beautiful. Gradually, those skills, which are the skills of awakening, which are the skills of the spiritual life, which are the skills of Buddha nature, if you want to call it like that, those are all skills that are completely and utterly natural to you. But they don't feel natural until you wake up to the very deep truth that they're not coming from outside you. They are emerging from within you. And your sadness, your true sadness, is also part of that. When your sadness is very great, that is also part of what I'm talking about. And so what should you do with this sadness when it arises? You also bring it to this place of peace. You also bring it to this acceptance and love, so that the sadness itself has a place to rest. Not so that you will rush to transform it so you can always be smiling and clapping. On the contrary, you sit with it and you allow it its space and its spaciousness without feeling that it is completely overwhelming you. And there will be moments in which it does overwhelm you, and those moments will pass. There were several really fundamental, very simple points I wanted to make. One of them is that everything passes. You know this. You know this. And yet, and that example of sadness, or that example of loss, or that example of desolation, or that example of bitterness or rage, so great that it seems to have be all that you are, whatever it is. It's odd, isn't it, that we know intellectually, we even know experientially that everything passes, and yet sometimes we are seduced into thinking, but this won't pass. Yeah? But this won't pass. Or we cling to something that is good and we kind of thingify it and we almost spoil our pleasure in it by holding to it too closely because we're so afraid it will pass. And it will, because everything passes. But that is the very first thing that I really wanted to draw your attention to on this Good Friday. And in a way so apt that it is Good Friday, that your life, however long you live, and I know some of you in this room have mothers who are in their 90s, and some of you have mothers who didn't even make it to 40. Some of you might have had mothers who didn't make it to 30. Some of you might have had children who were born only to pass immediately on into the next life, which isn't really the next life, it's the same life, but it's the onward. So, life is brief, life is brief, life is brief and precious. This is the simplest teaching that I could possibly give you, because everything else flows from it. Rumi says, with life as short as a half-drawn breath, why would you plant anything but love? Why would you plant anything? And what he means by planting is not just planting. It also means watering with your attention, coming back to it again and again and again and again. Hovering over it. Rumi. He's a funny little image of Rumi, which I don't think is really much like Rumi, but it was bought for me by such a dear friend in Konya, which is where Rumi's physical remains remain. Why would you plant anything but love? So this is the news of the day. The news of the day is that not one of us is immortal. And yet, don't we often behave as though we are? Don't we often put off? Better to avoid regret. So this is something to really bring to your quiet time. Is there anything I am postponing, particularly in terms of attitude? Or is there anything I am postponing, particularly in terms of courage? When I wrote Forgiveness and Other Acts of Love in a very, very tough time, I started with courage because whenever we make a change, particularly a change of mind, which is really a change of thinking and attitude, which the mind allows and the soul encourages, yeah? Think of the mind, for example, now, right now. Think of the mind as an instrument of the soul. The soul is trying to reach us all the time, and the mind is its vehicle, bringing in, giving out, bringing in, giving out, bringing in, giving out, which is why we have to be so careful about what we bring in. But we also have to be incredibly careful about what we sow, what we tend, what we pay most attention to, what we water, what we cultivate, and what we harvest. And what we harvest. And what we harvest depends a very, very great deal on how we apprehend and interpret. And those processes of apprehension, of how we bring something in, what story we tell ourselves about it. Yeah? There's a lot of fluidity there. There's really a lot of fluidity. We can make significant changes, but we need to choose to. So this is this. I'm coming now to the second. We can return to all of these things because really, you know, in a lifetime of seeking, this is pretty much what I think we need to know. This is what I think we need to know, but we need to experiment with it for ourselves. Heaven on Earth, I've got this great teaching from the Buddha which says, believe nothing because someone else has told it to you. You know, experiment. Find out, is this true for you? You know, just because the Buddha said it, or just because His Holiness the Dalai Lama said it, or, you know, our beautiful teacher Thich Nhat Hanh said it, or Jesus said it, or, you know, it was given in Deuteronomy through the voice of God. But still, experiment. Is it true for you that life is short and precious? And with life as short as a half-drawn breath, why would you plant anything but love? Think perhaps too of what you could give up for the sake of love. What could you give up for the sake of love?
Stephanie, can I just add in here that one of the most encouraging statements that you make in choosing happiness was the moment in life when you realise that everything passes, the relief of that, the acceptance of that, and I found that immensely helpful.
Mm-hmm. But it also, what comes with this is a responsibility which is also deeply true. Now, I'm not asking you to believe it, I'm asking you to experiment with it. That with this awareness that life is both brief and incredibly precious, that your gift of life is intrinsically precious, with this also comes a responsibility. That there are innumerable crossroad moments in our lives, in our ordinary everyday lives, when we could heal or harm. When we could nourish or deplete. When we could injure or encourage. Yeah? There are innumerable moments in our lives. And again, I want to say to you, we can be so sensitive to what others are doing without fully recognizing that the responsibility that comes with the knowledge that life is brief and precious is also the source of our growing into ourselves. It is the source of our power to choose wisely and well, and to recover when we do not. So how you experience, this is the second of these points I really want to make, but perhaps it's the 55th. So how we experience and how we interpret all the things that are happening to us depends on what we believe life is. And it also depends, and sometimes this is less conscious, on what we believe life owes us. What does life owe us? Does life owe us anything more than life? And yet, sometimes our responses tell us that we are very aggrieved, that we haven't got what we expected to have. At the very beginning of the Dhammapada, which is a collection that was kept in an oral way for hundreds and hundreds of years, but it's a collection of sayings from the Buddha. And at the very beginning it says this really provocative thing. With your thoughts, you make the world. And then it goes on to say that if your thoughts are routinely troubled, or routinely bitter, or routinely angry, or divisive, or hateful, then misery will follow you, as the night follows the day. If your thoughts are routinely, at least somewhat good-humoured, at least somewhat forgiving of other people for being as human as you are, and as flawed as you are, and as muddled as you are, and as idiotic as you are. We owe all those things too. If we can tolerate that, if we can tolerate the complexity of our human existence and find joy in it, and find some wonder in it, and find some companionship in it by offering ourselves as companions also to others. If we can bring a generosity of spirit to our encounters, it says it in fewer words than that, then happiness will follow us as night follows the day. So much depends upon that attitude that we have. And again, I want to make a proviso here. It doesn't mean that on every single day when something has happened to you that is deeply hurtful or disturbing, you should be jolly, jolly, jolly. Of course not. But that too will pass if you allow it. And then third of these simple, profound truths that I thought about bringing you today is that change is possible. Some of you, I think, were at the January day we had in Auckland, where I talked about self-acceptance and change as being deep soulmate partners. Self-acceptance, and I'm going to say more about self-acceptance because I know what a struggle it is for so many of us, but the self-acceptance is what allows change. It's funny, isn't it? We often think in ordinary thinking outside a spiritual context that we need to change in order to accept ourselves. We need to have a sort of scrubbed up version of who we used to be, you know, in order that we'll be good enough for the next chapter. On the contrary, we need to accept ourselves exactly as we are. Resting on this knowledge that our gift of human life, that our gift of soul conscious life, that our gift of abundance of life is itself something to be unconditionally accepted. And that was also what I wrote about in Choosing Happiness, in that section that Hilary referred to. It's not just that life will pass, everything within life is passing, and therefore let's pay attention to what we are paying attention to. It's also that when I moved from seeing self-acceptance as being primarily about the personality self or about the ego or about the even this transitory physical experience of life, when I came to a deeper knowledge that this is a soul incarnating in a body, or this is a Buddha nature expressing itself in this moment as Stephanie, and in that moment as Jude, in that moment as Hilary, in that moment as Berging, and in that moment as Margaret, and so on and so on. When I came not to believe that, but to know it, to experience it somehow, and not easily, then it made self-acceptance inevitable. In fact, then it began to feel that accepting life was the least that I could do, because what more precious gift is there? Yeah? But that also takes us immediately to considering the other. Because if I truly accept that my own life is a gift, then I must accept that every other life is a gift, no matter how flawed or distorted or disgusting or disgraceful it is in my perception of it. Yeah? So this question of self-acceptance and change is really wonderful, and I'm going to finish this first talk with this because it's already quite a lot. If we accept that our life is a gift, then we are also free to experiment that we have already within us the gifts of strength that we need. And again, this is a question of experimenting. And we experiment with it best when we allow ourselves to ask a very simple, very profound question when confusion arises, when hurt arises, when insult arises. The question that we can ask is, what is needed here? Sometimes I ask the question, what do I need? Sometimes I ask the question, what is needed here? What is needed here? Because sometimes it's a question of reaching out. Reaching out, setting false pride aside and reaching out. Yeah? Sometimes it's a question of, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And sometimes it's a question of allowing the sweet, gentle, divine feminine within just to tap you on the shoulder and to remind you, gentleness is needed here. Courage is needed. Remembering that this too will pass is needed here. Or remembering that you actually do feel very much better when you go for a long walk and allow yourself to surrender to nature. Or sometimes what's needed is to remember that you have a dear friend and that you can call Patsy and you can say, I just need to hear your voice. Or whatever it is. Yeah? And Viktor Frankl said this most wonderful thing, and his book, Man's Search for Meaning, which really means person's search for meaning, is one of the most significant texts for me. And he said this great thing, which is, when we can no longer change our circumstances, we are forced to change ourselves. But what he really meant was, we are forced to change our perspective. We are forced to grow bigger than we knew we were. And sometimes it is joy that grows us into the fullness of ourselves. And sometimes it is suffering. It's not the kind of mediocrity of life. You know, I'm awfully grateful when life is mediocre. You know, when nothing, you know, when it's just, I'm grateful actually, when there's no dramas one way or the other. I'm grateful. Could have more of that, please. But, you know, the creatures that we are, when we're thrown out of our comfort zone, when we're thrown out of our comfort zone, we are far more likely to shed another skin, shed another chrysalis, grow in the qualities that we need. And just before I finish, I want to say something about what I believe. I'm not asking you to believe it, and I'm not asking you to believe in beliefs. I want you to experiment. I've decided I'm a theistic Buddhist because I take most of my teachings from Buddhism. But I also take a lot of teachings from Judaism and from the teachings of Jesus himself and from the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita, so I'm definitely in the theistic stream. But these conduct questions that Buddhism gives us are just so great. And so this takes me to the fourth of these points, which is that I do believe this. We are here to discover and to express our true nature. That we are here to express our true nature. And that everything we do, right, wrong, fat, thin, high, low, good, not good, rewarding, distinctly unrewarding, is all about teaching us what our true nature is, what our potential is, to heal and not to harm, to heal and not to harm, to rejoice as well as to sorrow, to be a source of happiness as well as of consolation. Yeah? To be a presence that really allows us to love one another. The other day when I had a taxi with this most beautiful Samoan man, and I loved being with him because I lived in Samoa as a little girl. He was very happy to hear that, and he sort of knew where I'd lived, and, you know, we were family right away. It was really great. And we had a very deep talk right away. And he said, he was driving, but he put his hands together even though he's driving. And he said, every day I want to bring a little Jesus to the world. It's so sincere. And when I was thinking about love one another, I thought that beautiful teaching, beautiful teaching, which is really all we need to know. Love one another as I have loved you. And what that means is, I have loved you knowing who you are. Not because you had reached some kind of perfection. Loving you because you are on the margins. Loving you because you are who you are. Loving you because I can also forgive you. Loving you because I can also tolerate you. Loving you because I so want you to be able to tolerate me. Loving you because I can encourage you. And loving you because I also need your love. Loving you because I also need your encouragement. Loving you because we are in this together. Loving you because we are the many who have come from the one. Om Shanti.